Hi, everyone, and welcome to the AI Innovators Podcast. I'm Rob May. I'm the CEO of Nova and very active early stage angel investor. This podcast looks at all kinds of different AI companies, AI technologies, AI experiments, everything that is happening on the forefront of artificial intelligence. And I'm really, really excited for my guest today because he's in one of my favorite spaces. Some of you guys know I'm a former ASIC and FPGA designer. I got my start in hardware. And today I have the CEO of one of the top AI hardware companies in the country with us, Arun. I'm going to butcher your last name, even though I just asked you to say it. Iyengar?
That's right.
All right, Arun from Untethered, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so let's start with, let's jump into this issue that I think is really poorly understood by so many people who may be listening, which is GPUs, for all their success with AI, are still kind of holding us back. So can you explain to people why and what is going on in the market and with the technology that has caused this broad industry rush to so many new sources of compute?
Yeah, no, that's a very important question. You know, you look at how GPUs have come about, and I think they've done a really good job in staking out a claim in the AI world. GPUs at the fundamental level are being repurposed from going after graphics to using a lot of the similar types of processing to go after AI. And that actually works quite well. It works really well when you're doing training. And the little known fact is it works quite poorly when you want to do any inference. Why is that? Well, the traditional von Neumann architecture, so this is an architecture that's a load store architecture that was done in the 1940s, essentially means that you have data movement that comes from an external data source to an internal cache and then on into the place where you actually do the processing. And if you look at that movement of data for when you're doing inference, what you end up seeing is that 90% of the energy for that chip is used for just moving that data.
That's crazy.
And exactly. And so now you're looking at less than 10% of the power you're pumping into that GPU for inference is actually being used for inference. And that really is what makes it extremely power hungry and extremely power inefficient as it comes to inference deployment. And, you know, really, when you look at training versus inference, training is, as I'm sure your readers are all aware, is probably an eighth to a tenth of the entirety of the AI market, with inference being the largest component. And so you end up having to scale and deploy at large scales for going after the various customers that would want to use this AI particular model. And you are now burning power like there's no tomorrow. And that's why you end up with things like, I'm sure you've been looking at things like ChatGPT, right? And that's been something that's, you know, caught the world by storm in this year. And if you look at ChatGPT, and there's a variety of different analysis that people are doing, and it's really good work in terms of the types of analysis that they're doing. I just read this one, a particular one, where the guy says, if you look at the power that OpenAI uses for servicing its customers in the month of January, and you take that same power and you say, okay, how much power is that? That power, just for servicing users through inference for ChatGPT, is about the same power as is required to power a town of 175,000 people.
Wow.
Think about that. I mean, that's just crazy when you think about how much power is being spent. And so AI is amazing. It's really very useful and can do amazingly positive things for the world, but it cannot come in at this huge power penalty.
Yeah, so take us through the founding story of Untethered. What were you doing before? And then what made you aware of this issue? And then are you still, you know, AI has changed a lot. As you went down this path, are you still solving the same issue that you set out to solve? Or like, was it AI workloads? Or, you know, was this developed for sort of other purposes and sort of repurposed for this?
Yeah, that's actually a fun conversation. Our founders, when they were thinking about, one of our founders, he was a professor at a variety of universities in Toronto, including the University of Toronto. As he was going through back in the 90s, he came up with this idea of using what we call at-memory compute, where you put the memory and the processing right next to each other. And he was looking to use that for video, right? Video, as you know, notoriously long-tail content, very difficult to exactly say the sizing of it. And it ended up not being that great a fit. And then in the mid-2010s, as the AI world started taking off, he came up with the idea of, hey, look, I think I can use this really well for AI inference. And then he put that together and basically went out and pitched that to Intel Capital. Intel Capital said, you know what, that's actually a pretty good idea. I think we can give you some amount of money to go check the, do a test chip and prove out some of the things you're saying. And that's kind of the whole origin story for us, right? Which really took off from that perspective, from saying, okay, how do we come up with an at-memory compute architecture, which is a non-von Neumann approach that takes away the power penalty that the traditional von Neumann approach would take, which we talked about earlier, which is a 90%, going into the movement of data versus only 10% or less to actual AI inference processing. And in this case, we could move the majority of the usage towards actual AI processing. As we started the company, the focus was really still on efficiency, and we continue to, every day internally, as we talk about with our engineering teams, we're talking about femtojoules this, femtojoules that, as we look at every component of the AI chain. And we're really at that level looking at power and power usage. In terms of the specific markets, as you know, the markets change and are changing rapidly. So if you came out and said, look, I'm doing the world's best convolutional chip, I think you would have no customers by now.
Right. So
you really have to be thinking about, whatever is available today, you have to be able to do that. And then you have to do a plus. And the plus is the flexibility for what could come tomorrow. Right. So you end up with, doing vision systems. Okay, today vision systems are still, convolutional networks, but, they're moving to different types of networks. But then you also have transformers coming in, the vision transformers coming into vision systems. So you got to be able to solve that. You got to be able to do natural language processing, including things like BERT and now, of course, the whole GPT generative pre-trained models. You got to be able to do, things like DLRM for recommender systems. And of course, as you start thinking about the types of things that all of these incorporate, then you end up also having to do some amount of, linear algebra for the, if you want to go after any of the government systems. So there's a combination of a variety of things. And at the heart of what we do, we're really saying, okay, how do we do a very flexible, fundamental chip that can do a variety of things that we know of today, but are also capable of doing things that are yet to come tomorrow.
Interesting. And so would you say that let me back up. There's a bunch of parts to a chip that matter, right? There's power consumption, there's performance, whatever that may be defined as, in this case, maybe, inference processing. There's footprint, there's cost, there's all the things around it. What's the software stack look like to get the chip, programmed, and how much of that is new and all these kinds of things. How have you weighed those against each other? And it sounds like maybe you've prioritized sort of more general purpose compute and power consumption as the main vectors that you're sort of attacking with your architecture. Is that accurate?
Yeah, you've hit upon all the things that are really, really important for any chip company to kind of figure out, who they want to be when they grow up. You got to be able to say, what are the things that will differentiate you relative to anybody else? And the fundamental component that we've chosen with the at-memory compute architecture, because we now have very small movement of data, our goal is for any given watt, we can have the most throughput relative to anybody else in the world. And the other thing we do is because our data movement is so small, there's no necessity for us to batch anything, which means for any given network, we have the lowest latency that you can have. So the highest throughput for any given amount of wattage and the lowest latency, right? Those are the two key things that we are really focused on. And all of that has an umbrella. And the umbrella is, how good is your software? Because we might have the best chip in the world, but if it takes our customers some challenging time to actually use it, then guess what? It's just never going to be used. Going after a very general approach that we have chosen means we really have to have a very broad usage of our software. One of the first things I told the software team when we started going after, you know, creating the software was I said, look, one of the absolute necessities is that you shall not retrain your customer network. And that's an important criteria because the goal is not to say, look, Mr. Customer, let me take your network, because most people are loath to give their networks to us, but let's assume that they can. And then let me retrain it so that I can get you the best performance possible, because that's what I need to do for my chip. That basically means now the customer is a captive customer and their ability to look at other choices are being taken away. And that becomes a big problem for them, especially when it's not an incumbent like an NVIDIA or one of the large companies. So our goal was really to say, you know, the software has to be something that is almost a push button type of an approach, which means we go from one of the popular frameworks, let's say TensorFlow, PyTorch, or maybe even an Onyx representation. And from there, all of that is done in Python. And from there, the customer should be largely, you know, they don't need to know what the construct of our chip is, because all of that is taken care of by the SDK. Right. And that's a very easy thing to say, but it's a really difficult thing to do, to get it across a variety of different types of networks. And that's kind of where we've been putting a lot of our energy and focus to make sure that for all the types of networks we're going after, for all the variety of things that our customers want to do, we have an SDK that allows them to do what they need to from a push button perspective. Now, we do have a second view within that same thing, which is we do have certain customers that say, you know what, I really want to do my things my own way, and I'm quite comfortable going down. You said you were an FPGA ASIC guy, Rob. So you understand, you know, RTL programming, and you understand how deep that can get. And so we have some customers that are very comfortable with that type of an approach, and they actually resist saying, you know, a push button. So we do have what we call a power user approach for those guys that can come in and essentially create their own kernels if they choose to, but then use the rest of the tool chain to implement it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And it actually kind of leads into my next question, which is, for a startup, compared to doing software, building a chip takes a lot longer and it requires a very different mindset. You can't really like move fast and break things. You can't throw these chips out there because, you know, and just see what happens, because they're going to be designed into products that are going to be years, possibly decades out working in the market. How does that translate into how you approach product development and work in general from a leadership, executive, managerial perspective, from design perspective, you know, compared to like doing a software company?
Yeah. So the key there is, how do you do a lot of the hardware software co-design? The first time around when we did something, we kind of did a lot more in the hardware than we did in the software. And then as we implemented the software, we figured out some of the things we should have been doing with the hardware. So for our second generation, we basically went to a very strong hardware software co-design. We actually tried things out through a simulator that allowed us to figure out how we would actually perform on an equivalent hardware, made changes. We ran some nets, by the way, through those simulators to see, okay, you know, for a transformer type of net, what type of throughput and performance would we get? For a vision type of net, what would we get? For something else, you know, what would we get? And we made quite a few changes based on that feedback. Because you're right, it takes a long time to actually codify what you do through, you know, Verilog or any other component into the hardware, get that into a chip that gets taped out. And then if you say, okay, after that point is when I actually start developing my software, then you've basically lost the ability to do anything meaningfully different other than whatever we chose to put in the silicon. So that iteration aspect is valuable, and it's very, very important. And you know, for anybody that's out there trying to figure out, okay, I want to start my own chip company, you kind of want to get that recipe figured out early on. Doing that after the fact or ignoring it is just going to be disastrous.
So you're in a space that, as I mentioned before, has these like fascinating competitive dynamics to me, because the time between when you conceive of something, get it built and get it to market is much longer than it is with software, which is where I've spent the last 15 years of my career since being a hardware designer. And there's a bunch of companies in the AI hardware space making AI chips. And I also assume that, you know, in addition to NVIDIA working on the next generation of all their stuff, you have companies doing, you know, Apple and Google sort of making their own chips for their own use cases and those things as well. So tons and tons of innovation in this space, which is pretty exciting. But from a competitive perspective, you know, running a company in the space, how do you think about competition in light of all this? And what's the framework that you figure out to, how do you decide what vectors to compete across? How do you play it so that Untether is one of the winners in this space? Like, what drives success?
Yeah, this is one of the existential questions that, you know, pretty much all of us have to figure out and come up with an answer to that is not just an in-the-moment answer, but it's an answer that can sustain us as we move forward in time. And as I talked about earlier, you know, one of the things we have done, to recap, we basically are focused on doing a very efficient at-memory compute architecture, which gives us, for any given power profile, we have the highest throughput at the lowest latency. And we use that as our fundamental differentiation from against everybody else. Now, as we think about, you know, a variety of different markets we go into, there are certain things that we've chosen to be so that, you know, it's easier for us to say this is the sandbox we're choosing to play in. We are a deep learning accelerator. We're not an SoC, where typically you have some companies closer to the edge where you have a processor, the host processor, along with a variety of other accelerators, including a neural net accelerator that's built in. And at that point, you know, the neural net accelerator is probably 10 to 25% of the chip size. Everything else is for the rest of it. We've chosen to say, as of now, really the only focus we have is on a pure play deep learning accelerator, which means we need to have a host processor. It could be an x86, it could be ARM, it could be RISC-V. Doesn't matter, but there's a host that we have to integrate and engage with. We've also said we are going after the inference part. We're not going after training. The architecture that we have is capable of supporting training. So don't get me wrong. It's not that we cannot do training. It's just we've chosen not to go after training. So it's very important to define the parameters under which you know we want to be in and be successful. And so once we define the market we want to go into, we then said, okay, what are the markets we want to actually, the applications we want to get into? So we talked about the whole vision system. So what are vision systems? These are things like autonomous vehicles, smart city, smart retail, things like robots. So that's one class of applications that we're going after. Another class of applications are things like the government applications. So here, it's really a lot related to, you know, linear algebra, related to simulation, along with a variety of the vision as well as transformer systems. Right here, we have things like, you know, maybe we're doing some type of ballistic missile analysis to see where it's going to land, where the intercept point could be. Maybe we're doing some type of anomaly detection algorithm, which allows us to see as, you know, as a drone's going by, to say, oh, wow, hey, look, even though I'm targeting that particular thing, I saw something anomalous here. Let me capture it. Let me go back. And when I go back, I can point out to it, right? So there are those types of activities or applications that show up there. And then we're also looking at, you know, the traditional data center class applications where it's, you know, like NLP, natural language processing, on-premises servers. And then the final one we go after is the banking and financial services. So the reason why I walked through the markets, the applications we're going after, as well as the sandlot that we choose to play in, then defines, you know, who we choose to compete against. And so while there are probably, I don't know, 50, 60, 70, I don't know the exact number of AI chip startups that are out there, when it comes to the definition of what we've gone through here, we really end up seeing ourselves and NVIDIA as, NVIDIA obviously is a common thread across multiple places, but right. We definitely see them, or the GPUs, I should say, not just NVIDIA, GPUs as a key competitor. And so then it becomes, okay, against that competitor, how do you differentiate yourself, right? The differentiation has to happen. You have to have a multiplier differentiator against an entrenched incumbent. You can't just be 10 or 20 or 30 or 40% better. You got to be 3x, 5x, you know, 10x better than the competitor. And you got to be able to have a software development kit that is easy to use.
Yeah, I think you're really smart to take that approach. I think there's a lot of focus on AI that focuses on training. And it has the eye-popping numbers, you know, what it costs to train the next version of GPT, whatever, and how that's a barrier to entry for all these companies and blah, blah, blah. And I think everybody's really focused in the sort of news side of the business on what's coming that'll lower that price. But I think to your point, the inference market is probably bigger now and will be definitely be bigger over the longer term, just because you do so much more of it, right? Once you train a model. And I know you guys have some really great investors. You know, I know we got introduced by the Radical guys, who I think are some of the smartest people in AI. And I'm sure they're pretty helpful as you guys think through this.
Yeah, no, our investors have been amazing. We've got, as I said earlier, Intel Capital that, you know, have continued to help us from day one. We've had Radical Ventures who have been really very good with respect to showing us towards the AI activities that, you know, are not just happening today, but what may be coming in the future. We have GM Ventures that have been with us since our A round. And, you know, as I said earlier, we do have an activity going on with GM for their next gen perception systems. And then we also have other deep pocketed investors. We have the Tracker Capital guys who are from the Cerberus private equity company. They're the VC arm of Cerberus. And they're extremely well connected in the government space, where, you know, we've had some amazing conversations through them. And then we have one of the largest pension plans in the world, a Canadian pension plan. All right, they're also our investors. So I'm very fortunate to have some really high quality investors supporting us.
That's great. As we get close to wrapping up, there's a lot of entrepreneurs that listen to this podcast, and they always want to know what they should be working on. So I always like to ask if there's any technology problems that you aren't solving at Untether, but that you wish someone else would work on to make your life easier?
Yeah, that's always a great question. When it comes to AI, there's a whole host of application activity that's still completely out there. I think we're probably just scratching the surface of AI in terms of how it can be used. So for entrepreneurs that are looking to do AI-related activities, I mean, I'd say from an application perspective, it's really limited by your imagination. We've talked to people that have done some amazing things with AI, including, as I'm sure you've seen, quite a few related to climate modeling, things like that kind of help us predict where the next big disaster could happen and what could be done to support it. There's a whole host of things that we need to figure out with respect to AI and energy and the sustainability aspect of it. So there's a lot of innovation that needs to come around there as well. So, I mean, these are all from an application perspective. If you really want to be a chip guy, then I'd rather not tell you what to do, but I'll tell you how to go about it. And that is figure out a differentiation. The things that, Rob, you were asking me, those are all the very key and important questions. If you can't figure out how you're going to be better and better by a factor of 10x against the incumbents, then really there's no point starting something that can be successful.
Yeah. Since you brought it up, the people that might be chip designers, what are you seeing in the market for hiring electrical engineering talent these days? Because, you know, when I came out of school in 2000, it was still probably equal to computer science in terms of what people went into. But I heard there's a shortage, and I'm curious if you see that in the market and if you think that might resolve itself in the coming years.
With all the changes, right, through 2022, with all the interest rate increases, there was a lot of conversation around a recession coming our way, and a recession that would come across, you know, a variety of different markets, including the silicon market. We've had, as I'm sure you've tracked as well, Rob, we've had quite a few companies announce layoffs. We've had people that have also shut down some of their chip activities, large companies. And it's been quite interesting because during the pandemic, hiring people was the biggest challenge. And so when I was going through 2022 and I was looking at a lot of the people that companies were eliminating, or roles that they were eliminating, I should say, I was thinking, okay, well, this might change in terms of the ability to hire people. Maybe it'll be a lot easier. It hasn't been. It's still a very competitive market out there.
Yeah,
there is still a shortage of talent, and it has not, you know, companies that lay off people, what I find is they're all out there with some of them with 3 to 4 offers in their hands, right? Yes, it's taken them maybe 5 weeks to 6 weeks now to find a job with those multiple offers versus the 2 to 3 weeks during the pandemic. But still, it's still, you know, it's still a great market to be an electrical engineer.
Yeah. So I like to end on a personal question for everybody that comes on, which is, what is one piece of advice that someone gave you or you read or you learned along the way in your career that you just think is really important and that you'd like to pass on to our listeners?
Communications. The biggest thing that I find is, as a CEO, as anybody running a company, especially as we're distributed, the ability to communicate and come up with ways for people to communicate with each other, come up with means by which you've got platforms that allow people to collaborate and communicate with each other. That is the single biggest challenge and impediment. And if you solve that well, then what you'll find is people trust each other. Then you end up with people saying, oh, and I know exactly what that person's doing because I've seen what they're going to do, or they've talked to me. And there is not any of this thing of, oh, wow, I don't know what they're doing because I haven't heard about them. I don't know what the heck they're doing. So I can't trust what they're doing is going to be useful for me. That's typical human nature. And so when you have a distributed workforce, which pretty much most people do now with all the pandemic and post-pandemic activities, you really have to come up with communication. And I end up over-communicating. We do a lot of communication on a weekly basis. We spend a lot of time, and it's deliberate in terms of how we go communicate. It's not just random. It has a theme. It has a purpose, and it has an end goal. So every week, there is that type of thought process and activity that we go through at Untether. And I tell you, we do have a lot of good feedback on that from our employees because they do feel like they understand what's going on. They do feel there's a lot of transparency that's within the company, exactly for the fact that we're communicating and communicating across the variety of activities that are happening within the organization.
I couldn't agree more. So that is a great answer to end on. Arun from Untether.ai, thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thank you, Rob.
And for those of you listening, if you want to learn more about Untether, you can go to untether.ai, read a little bit more about the company. And as always, please listen to our other podcasts, rate us, download us, whatever you want to do. If you know somebody who should be a guest, please email me, rob@novacloud.ai. Thank you for listening.